Hello and welcome to a special Culture File programme on Michelangelo Merisi, better known by the screen name Caravaggio, currently in Rome as a hugely ambitious exhibition dedicated to the paintings of the painter, transported from their homes as far away as Fort Worth and, of course, Dublin, and brought together in the Palazzo Barberini, where for a few weeks more you'll find some of the artist's most famous works, such as Dublin's Taking of Christ, looking very well as another recent Caravaggio rediscover, Madrid's Ecce Homo, offering a once-in-a-lifetime moment to reflect on the artistic and cultural revolutions of the master. Taking the opportunity to do just that along with me today are Colm Tobin and Orit Gat, and we've been all lucky enough to see the show and indeed do some e-scootering, not all of us, around the Eternal City to other places, home to even more and even more immovable Caravaggio works. Hello, panel.
But I want to just say, Buonasera, Roma. Do you remember that with the former Pope? It's the first thing he said when he was made Pope. So I think we should all say that. Buonasera, Roma.
Buonasera, Roma.
You've got great R's, though. I haven't got the R's to do that. So, Orit, if we could start with you. The last time there was such a gathering of these pictures was back in 1951 when Roberto Longhi, who's a famous Italian historian and art critic, sort of rediscovered Caravaggio and brought him to the world and, you know, instigated all sorts of things like Tom Gunn's poem in Maria del Popolo, which we might get to later and might even pronounce properly. So why do we need another show like this, Orit?
There has been an interest in major retrospectives for old masters. Recently, there was a Vermeer exhibition that I feel like everyone in Europe traveled to Amsterdam, to the Rijksmuseum, to see. I can't remember the number of Vermeers, but there are only 36 Vermeers in the world, and there were more than 20 in that show. And so I feel like the combination of an opportunity to not reassess, because by now we all come to Caravaggio with a certain sense that we know what it is, that there'll be darkness, that there'll be action, that we know some of the subjects, but also the opportunity to see them next to each other and develop something that's closer to an emotional connection to paintings when you are actually standing in front of them and seeing them together.
But there is also this thing that it's made into an event, so that, you know, going and seeing a picture just isn't enough. And the only way to really like feel anything at all is to go to a room where there are 50 works. And then we might begin to feel something.
One of my friends was asking, how was it? To which I responded, well, it was great. It was a Caravaggio show. And then I was like, oh, you know, there are 24 paintings in the show, so it's not the hugest show I've ever seen. And he responded with, it's 24 Caravaggios.
The experience of Caravaggio in Rome, for anyone who's in Rome when this show isn't on, is really interesting, because you can go into Santa Maria del Popolo and you put some money, you put a tiny amount of a euro into a thing, and the lights come on for a certain length of time. They always go off too fast, but you can see the conversion of St. Paul, the road to Damascus, in situ. Now, it can't be moved. And there's another church, the Church of the Francesi in Rome, where you can see the extraordinary painting of Jesus appearing to St. Matthew. I mean, not as a god, but as a man who's busy with his job. He's an accountant. Suddenly at the door, this man's beckoning. It's extraordinarily dramatic. It gives you a sense of, oh no, don't come looking for me. You see, I'm busy. But they're part of not the ordinary experience of Rome, but the experience of being in Rome, seeing the things one by one. There are real problems if you're not alert on a given day. And I don't think it's just me. There are some days where I'm alert and anything can happen if I see a painting. I mean, I can spend an hour looking at one. And other days when I'm not like that. And I was slightly jet-lagged in Rome, and I went twice, but it didn't do the same to me as it did to my friends. I thought the Dublin painting, the Taking of Christ, it's interesting how it was lit and how it was positioned. And I'm interested in the difference between the way it's presented here in the National Gallery in Dublin, where it's just part of the gallery experience. It's not a single room. I mean, there must be a temptation to put it into a room on its own, light it properly, and do ancillary material around it. I think you could do the same in Dublin with the Vermeer. But I admire them for not doing that, because I think it would belittle the experience of just being in the National Gallery and moving from space to space and seeing other work, you know, that it just would make it, oh, let's just do Blockbuster. And Blockbuster is a problem if you're trying to see something and let it enter into your spirit, as you can with these Caravaggios, where something at the side, some face, some funny robe, there's a constant sense. What is the center of this painting? And why is my eye wandering from it towards the side? It's a remarkable experience, this. It was nice. It was nice to be there. But I love the old Villa Borghese in Rome, and the fact that there are some of the lovely sexual paintings, you know, where you can just see how interested he is in what we might call male beauty or male sexual beauty. But it was good. It was nice. but there was a strange patriotism when I saw the Dublin one and thought, look at this. Does everyone in Dublin know how beautiful this looks here and how proud we should be of it, as though somehow the nation had been involved in making it?
I was absolutely feeling that, like I had painted it or something. That's my picture there. All right, Colin touches on it there, that other people are kind of the issue here, because the way you consume a Blockbuster show is not really a very poetic experience. It's about kind of wading through great crowds of people holding their camera phones aloft. I mean, the camera phone is a whole world of its own, but I guess in our lives now, we raise the camera phone to honour the moment. Like, this moment is special, like showing the monstrance around the church or something. So we're honouring the paintings by lifting up our camera and showing them to our camera. But it's something that's not totally useful for you if you want to go and look at the paintings with your eyes.
So I walked to the French church from the Barberini after seeing the Caravaggio exhibition. And I had both experiences of going into the Caravaggio exhibition, which was so busy. And I am 5'2". And I had to kind of move between people and try and clamber over people. But I also, in a way, I spent a huge amount of time there because I also flew a huge distance. And it felt, I had this sense of occasion around it. And so I felt like some of the people that I walked in with, I've separated from at some point. They disappeared because they finished seeing the exhibition while I was still in the second room. And then I walked to the church and I had that experience of being in Rome and walking through very busy streets and walking into a very empty church and standing alone in front of these paintings. Like, if you're there, you're not always there to pray. You're often there to see the Caravaggio, but I was there alone. And I mean, I recommend it. It's lovely to see an exhibition alone. It's also lovely to see people experiencing something. This is why we go to the cinema, is to be with other people while we're having a cultural experience.
But that I'm specifically talking about that experience through the phone.
Interesting. I mean,
you didn't. I presume neither of you took out your phone and snapped.
I took so many photographs. What are you talking about?
Of the Caravaggios.
Of the Caravaggios, kind of as aide-mémoires. Like, I looked at them on the plane here before we met, just to remember what I looked at, what my favorite details were, for example. So, like, I have a focus on the mirror in the Martha and Mary Magdalene painting, which I just wanted to have the detail of. I also take a lot of photos of the wall labels so that I remember some of the stories or how facts are given by the authority of the show rather than the facts that are given to you by the authority of Wikipedia, mm-hmm. for example.
And did you find overlap between those two?
Well, The Narcissus, which I'm sure we will spend a lot of time on, but The Narcissus is dated 17 different days, not 17, but like, it could be from 1590, it could be from 1597, it could be from 1599. And in the wall text, it just says, like, there are several dates given to it, but on the caption, there is no date. They won't commit. Little details like that interest me.
The Narcissus is the first thing you see when you go in, Colm. Like, it sets a tone for it. Tell us about that painting. What were you seeing there?
Well, I think you're looking at, first of all, light and dark. I mean, no matter what you do, you start with the idea that the background seems black, and therefore out of that can come all sorts of light. And the way light comes on fabric, light comes on material, but also the way the face is. Now, the fact that he's never going to do something directly. And it is, I think, that idea that happens to artists where you think, what is life? And how come life is not being reflected in art? How come we're getting an idealization of life? We're getting, you know, people staring outwards from a picture, which people never do in a group. So you're getting even, you know, the virgin with the baby, holding the baby tenderly. Well, when does that happen? Why doesn't the baby cry? Why doesn't the virgin have, for example, dirty feet? Because people going around bare feet do. In this case, of course, it's all about the angle. That if Narcissus is looking at water, how come the sense of looking and the reflection isn't captured as though it's happening? Not as being idealized, not that Narcissus looks particularly great either, but the sense, first of all, of skill, of the way the reflections are done, but also the oddness of where limbs, I mean, where are knees, where are just the way the hands are, the sense of, for example, Narcissus has to, in order to do this, pull up the sleeves. There's a constant sense in the paintings, especially the religious paintings, of I will no longer allow all these people to look outwards or to seem in a pose that they would never have been in. I want to see if there's a possibility, the pose of life, the way in which someone is untidily there, the way in which a face seems to come into the crowd from nowhere and hold your attention, that all that has to be captured. And people often talked about paintings as being Bibles for the illiterate, Bibles for the poor, or Bibles for people who couldn't read, but that he wants no longer, as people more could read, then the other thing was needed, drama, action, the dark background and the light coming in. But the sense of untidiness, the constant sense of this being a moment, a sort of provisional thing.
All right, this is one of the ones which brings us instantly to the question of what is a Caravaggio? Is it a Caravaggio? This is one of the ones that's been kind of debated for quite a while. Was this actually a Caravaggio? How are you feeling after seeing it? Does it sit with everything else, or is there any clues that, you know, they've seemed to have finally decided this is really a Caravaggio? They're going with that.
I think they're going with that because the exhibition was in the museum that owns this painting. This is a very good way of claiming that it is a Caravaggio to open a major exhibition with this painting. I looked at my notes from university in preparation for today. So when I was 20 years old, which is a very long time ago, I took a class on Caravaggio and Caravaggisti, and my final assignment in that class was about the attribution of this painting, which was also hanging in my bedroom when I was a student. Very cute. Obviously, a reproduction of it, not the painting. I would have loved it if the painting hung in my bedroom when I was a student.
Well, if it's not a Caravaggio, it's a possibility.
But one of the strongest claims why it is not a Caravaggio is that it is not mentioned by any contemporary of his, and it has never been painted by any of Caravaggio's followers. So almost every subject that Caravaggio painted, from lute players to Cupid, has been picked up by many, many followers all over Europe. No one else paints a Narcissus. It is already a really rare subject in art. But seeing it in real life and seeing it open the exhibition, first of all, it has a bit of that note that, Colm, you talk about, like desire and a proximity to a moment. You walk in on the action. Like, obviously, like, this is a moment of reflection, but it also feels really immediate. The sleeves were just rolled up. We're walking into that. Feels like incredibly Caravaggio. It also feels incredibly romantic and lonely. And to set the tone to an exhibition like that, that was very biographical in the way it talked about Caravaggio, his life, basically following the paintings according to when he's in Rome, when he's not in Rome. It's very linear, but it tells you everything in the context of crime and punishment, basically. But this painting feels a bit different in all of them. It also, I want it to be a Caravaggio because I love it, because I think it's beautiful, because I think that when you see it in real life, something about the quality of the fabric, the fact that the fabric looks just like the fabric in a couple of other Caravaggio paintings. So there's a penitent Magdalene at the Doria Pamphili in Rome, and one of the boys in the card sharps, I think, also wears this kind of brocade-y green fabric. And so it must have been a studio prop. That is a really good argument why it is a Caravaggio. But also, maybe another really good argument why it is a Caravaggio is we all want it to be.
Colm, we're talking there about the starting of the exhibition, but maybe we'd say something about the starting of your interest in Caravaggio, because what happened to Caravaggio in the quick retelling is that after his death, he was never a totally popular guy with even the people he was working for, never really enjoyed him. He was a bit of a rapscallion of one sort or another. It happened that very soon after he died, people lost interest in what he was doing completely. But yet, by the middle of the 50s, all of that was changing. What had happened?
He had developed a reputation, which I think Christopher Marlowe also did, as a figure in a city who moved between high and low. In other words, he could get commissions, very serious ones from the church. His paintings could be in the most important churches in Rome. But in a sense, once night fell, one could never tell where Caravaggio would be, just as Christopher Marlowe, you know, and that they both ended violently. So it's this sense of him that he was flitting between countries. There's a moment where he's in Malta. Why is he in Malta? Who did he murder? And who murdered him? And so, you know, it isn't as though he was Titian, you know, who lived to be old and even outlived a plague. You know, that Titian lived into his 90s and was always looking after his work and selling it to kings and getting it to Spain and being famous in Venice. He isn't even, you know, he has a completely different name. Now, the poet Tom Gunn, who was born in 1928, became interested in the 50s in the idea of will, in the idea of violence, in the idea of somehow this male figure. Often he wrote poems about bikers, and he loved the idea of leather and people moving with big machines. You know, down the road they came, the boys. And so the very first poem in his book, which I have here, My Sad Captains, is called In Santa Maria del Popolo. And it is, of course, that is over to the left. And it was such a pilgrimage for me because, of course, I read the poem long before I ever saw a Caravaggio.
There wasn't one in Dublin at that point.
No, there wasn't one. But there wasn't even I'm not sure I was aware, you know, in the way that everyone loved Vermeer. You know, and there were books on Vermeer, even though you'd never seen a Vermeer. They were somehow or other so praised. It was the same with Goya. It was the same with Velázquez. It was the same with Titian. Some of the Caravaggio ones were so strange. Now, there's a wonderful moment in this where, you know, he's talking about seeing this painting, going in to see this painting by Caravaggio of the Roman school. And then he suddenly then just goes in, almost as an aside, describing the painting and the church. He goes, the painter saw what was an alternate candor and secrecy inside the skin. And then he goes, he painted elsewhere that firm, insolent young whore in Venus's clothes, those pudgy cheats, those sharpers, and was strangled as things went for money by one such picked up off the streets. So it's that sense of a myth surrounding Caravaggio, that if you're looking at a Caravaggio, you're not really looking at a religious subject or a portrait or the dark and the light. You're looking at how this man moved in this place in a way that was dangerous. In the same way as if you're reading Hero and Leander, the long poem by Christopher Marlowe, you're always aware, as Marlowe writes about beauty and male beauty, that there was something else going on. He was taking risks in his work. He was taking risks in his life. It's hard to think of two other figures who have the same. I mean, I know Van Gogh cut his ear off, but that was him to him. Whereas with Caravaggio, you always felt he always had, as it were, a knife ready, as did his friends, as did the friends of Christopher Marlowe. So when you're looking at these paintings, there's one in Syracuse, and you realize, what was he doing here? You know, he was on his way somewhere else. But it isn't as though the paintings seem quickly made by a man in a rush. It is that once he started, something else happened. And something else happened, which was a view that somehow the untidiness of life, the life he was seeing, what Tom Gunn calls the sharpers, the pudgy cheats, you know, Venus, was somehow being idealized by painters. Life was being idealized. And obviously, once you get the idea, why don't we just stop doing that? Is there anything we could then do? And you get that, I think, very much in The Taking of Christ, where there are figures in the painting that seem to come from the side and yet have a sort of a vivid expression or a presence or just an extraordinary amount of work done on the face. But they're not the Christ figure. They're even not the central figures around him. Often he puts in little self-portraits. There's a sense it's urgent for him. It matters somehow that this scene be captured in a way that seems, as I say, provisional, untidy, and yet the composition has a drama, an urgency, like something that was seen on the street rather than was taken from, say, the comfort of the Bible in order to teach people what had happened to these people from the Bible, from the New Testament. Instead, you make them dramatic. You give them extraordinary life. And this is done a lot of the times by painting flesh and by painting face. In other words, yeah, he does. His robes are great. Just look, we're looking here at the Narcissus. The robes are just great. But it isn't that. It is the way the face is held, the ear. And also the hands are so great.
One of the, you're suggesting there, like, that one of the points of Caravaggio, why we kind of are fascinated by him, is because he lived this kind of street life that we don't know about because it's invisible in most people's paintings. And he went, look, this street life is life. It's real to me and I'm going to present it here. Now, I may need a certain amount of mythology or Bible stories to justify it. I mean, Andrew Graham Dixon's biography suggests that he may have actually been a pimp. And this is why he was on the streets of Rome at all hours of the day and night and needed to carry so many daggers that he was actually running a harem of some sort, and that maybe the time when he got into big trouble and he murdered somebody, it was a duel about a woman that he was protecting. All of those stories are kind of, they form part of an archetype that we're really familiar with now of the romantic artist who's kind of troubled and living a bohemian lifestyle. But of course, the bohemian lifestyle doesn't exist here. It isn't a thing. The romantic ideal of the artist isn't a thing. And he kind of invents it backwards through the paintings by putting this kind of cast of everyday people from the street into the pictures. But I wonder now, that has that artifice grown so big around him? I mean, maybe it's a pearl that's growing on that little sort of uncomfortable bit, but has it grown so far around him that it begins to dominate the way we can look at the pictures, Orit?
Definitely. I definitely think that also in the time in which he's painting, there is already a kind of salacious hunger for these subjects, right? That is why he makes numerous copies of the fortune teller, who is actually stealing money from a rich boy. So she's holding his hand and telling his fortune, but you can see that she's taking something from him while she's telling his fortune. And there was a desire to collect this, there was a desire to have this. But then, Colm, you talk about how it wasn't Vermeer, it wasn't a Goya, it was forgotten or not thought about for a long time. And I wonder if, in a way, we now once again exist in or live in a society that is looking for something a little spicy and salacious, and it's a really safe version of that because it's from a very long time ago. But so much of the exhibition was really about cleaning up a lot of this history, right? Like, it talks about how he lived by his wits. This is a direct quote from one of the wall labels. I really enjoyed the biographical element of the exhibition just because it felt like, here is one person's story of how you lived in Rome in that moment. Like, he lived with this patron and then he lived with this patron. He made these paintings for the market, but also they were building a lot of churches in Rome at the time, and there was a lot of hunger for religious painting. So he was also making those.
I think there's also the question of him being gay, which is, of course, a complete anachronism. But nonetheless, the way in which the male figure is painted by him, the way in which young flesh, young male flesh, and it's the same with Christopher Marlowe, you know, that were they there in this underworld, this strange world where you could move between patrons and then produce a work that really no one could have mistaken some of these paintings, that the way in which flesh is done has extraordinary quantities of desire. And it seems the male more than the female, more than these paintings of women, these paintings of young men, they're really cheeky fellows. And you can see they were on the streets. And you can see that the way they're being painted, you know, they're not being idealized, but they are being sexualized.
Here's a question about desire and male and female bodies. One of my favorite things about Caravaggio is that his female characters have more psychology than most female characters that you see. His Judith beheading Holofernes looks horrified by it. She's pulling his hair, the blood is coming everywhere, and her face squinches and is so uncomfortable. And usually when a woman is painted by a man, she's not given these kinds of emotions. She's either available or not available. And I wonder how that feels when we talk about the men, and if, you know, you look at the Saint John the Baptist,
I was giving you Judith there, sorry. I'm not sure whether I should be interrupting you to put on pictures, but like, it's good to have them in the back.
I know, it's very exciting when you do this. I mean, it really is. And,
I do really like looking at them together.
You see, I think this is just one minor question about Caravaggio, that there's a debate going on between historians of homosexuality as to at what point there was a thing called same-sex desire, homosexuality, or at what point it was just so much a part of things that it didn't have a name. But it seems to me that Caravaggio really is an interesting figure in this, because some of those paintings of young men are unmistakable.
Oh, yeah.
That they're fully sexualized and that they're there for your delight in a way that women might have been painted in some other way or spoken about or dealt with. They're almost courtesans. They're almost, you know, they're taken in off the street and they haven't been washed yet, you know.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, oh my God, we're looking at the Judith. Oh, Lord, yes, you're absolutely right. And look at that fellow to her right with that extraordinary, the old man. The way in which he's given it, what a vicious looking fellow he is.
So I have a little thing that I wanted to do, a little scratch and sniff now, because as well as the Barberini show, there are these satellite shows. And as we were saying, many churches and other galleries where you can go and experience a Caravaggio all the time in Rome, but especially at this special period. But in the Villa Borghese, they have done a perfume collaboration in relation to the pictures that are in, there's a couple of pictures left in the Borghese that you can go and see if you hop on your e-scooter and come all the way down from the Palazzo.
Did you do that?
I did. I want to talk about e-scooters in general, actually.
Oh, right.
I've been to Rome a lot and like on art history trips and also there myself to look at pictures, and I've always found it a challenge. You know, that's another hour's walk in the beating sunshine. I'm not sure I'm up for that. But what you can do now is hop on an e-scooter or an electric bike, which is left all over Rome, zip up and down the Via del Corso and up the quite high hill to get to the Barberini Palazzo,
yeah.
And then all the way down to the Villa Borghese to see a couple more. And in the Borghese, they've gone all out and they have this perfume collaboration with an Italian perfume house, a Roman perfume house called Cor Eterno.
Well, hold on, look at these, the perfume.
These are the three perfumes that are Caravaggio themed. And the actual boxes that you can buy in the Borghese have the Caravaggio images on them. So this is the Sick Bacchus. And the perfume that they have relating to the Sick Bacchus is this thing called Night Idol. And I don't know if you're wearing something at the moment, either of you, but would you like to try the Night Idol?
I mean, just open it and smell it?
Maybe it'll put a little dab behind the ear on
I've
the
never
wrist,
done that.
Even.
I'm not that sort of homosexual. Oh, look, you see, I'd love if they could actually manufacture or fabricate human sweat. And you could feel some of those figures of Caravaggio are so filled with sweat, certainly the male figures.
Something salty.
Oh, this is nice. This is perfume.
It's for men.
Oh, look, I've just put it behind my ear.
Well done.
I've never done that before in my life.
A lot of perfume now is meant for men and women.
Yeah. My friend Andrew Hagan, who's a journalist in England, Scottish journalist and novelist, says that they're making perfumes now so that people can smell themselves. You know, the perfume used to be a time when you would love to be perfumed so someone else could like you. But now it's over. Now it's that people like themselves.
I feel like I have to tell you that I am currently wearing a perfume called Eau de Papier, which is supposed to smell like paper. And I love it.
Which is good for a writer.
Lovely.
Exactly. It's the writer's perfume.
I can't think of anything better. Yeah. God.
That is where we will blow out the lamp on our conversation on Caravaggio. I want to thank our couple of Caravaggisti, Colm Tobin and Orit Gat, for taking a walk with Caravaggio and myself. Colm and myself will be back in the comfort zone next week with Dr. Autumn Brown, when we'll be making some noise about silence. Till then, thank you, Orit.
Thank you.
Thank you, Colm.
Thank you.
Bye now.